We're a little bit backwards today because we're doing a workshop before our presentation. So we're going to take just a few minutes up front, and Anna and I will try to walk you through a little bit of who we are, where we come from, but most of that will be in the noontime keynote presentation. So my name is Doug Crabtree. This is my bride and partner, Anna Jones Crabtree. We farm and live north of Havre, Montana. That is north central part of the state. We actually farm right on the Canadian border. And I feel obligated to acknowledge a bit of an elephant in the room. We have what most would consider a rather large farm. We manage 12,500 acres. But I really need to put that in context, because in Montana, to relate to the Midwest, you have to take a zero off of the back of everything. So instead of 30 inches of rain, we get 3. Instead of 200 bushels of corn, we get 20 bushels of wheat. Instead of $10,000 an acre, our land costs $800 or $1,000. So just to put you in context, large is not quite as large as you might expect, but
big sky, big land, no people.
Yeah, and we are we're considered a frontier by definition, because there are fewer than 5 people per square mile, and that counts the town. So where we live, there are fewer people living on the land than there have ever been, and that's one of the problems, obviously. So we'll talk some more about that. But
so we became beginning farmers in 2009 in a place that we didn't actually grow up in, and bought land off the open market, used a lot of the USDA programs to do that. We're super lucky to have an FSA loan officer who actually was an organic grain farmer, who actually understood how to navigate the system. So without Dick Nicholson, we might not be here today. So what we wanna do is, in our keynote, we've done a little after action review of what's it been like 14 seasons, starting in 2009. What have we learned in a variety of topic areas? So what we wanna share today is what we've learned and what we're thinking about in terms of the economics and the larger capitalistic system that each farm has to live and survive and try and thrive in. And so what we're hoping to do is just take you through some of those slides to give you some thoughts, and then really just have an open conversation, because this is something that's gonna take all of us to create a new economic reality. And I really wanna learn from all of you what you're thinking or where your challenges are. So that's how we're gonna set up for today. And ask questions along the way. We really just want to have a dialogue.
Yeah, just be very open. If you have a question, a comment, an objection, please raise your hand, and we'll do our best to recognize and get those out right away.
So every farm that exists, this is a picture of our farm from Google, or two of our fields. So that's 1,280 acres, some of our well, actually, that's only 960 acres. That's some of our original farm land that we purchased. And we farm in 240-foot wide crop strips with 20 to 30 feet of buffers in between every one of those crop strips. So we look totally different than our neighbors. But every farm that exists, we think of it as kind of a beating heart or this sunshine, right? Like, it's doing things out to the community. It's its own being, its own organism. So, you know, we're doing food. We're trying to provide food. We're trying to provide education. We have an apprenticeship program that we've had since 2011. We're doing things like habitat and diversity and carbon storage and healthy soil and healthy people. And you guys all know that because you're all organic farmers. But what's become really obvious to us is the outside forces of climate instability, local culture, ag policy, capitalism. I think all of us need to start figuring out how we talk about those system influences in a way that's more holistic, because we need every single farm doing it differently to continue to exist. And in Montana, there's 18 million acres of cropland, and there's less than 1% of that that's certified organic. So we have glyphosate in our rainwater, whether we like it or not. So that's just a way to frame our conversation today. One of my favorite new farmers I've met is Beth Honecke. She's in Oregon. She's biodynamic. And she talks about, as much as I work on the farm works on me. So there's inner soil that my friend Stefan Schneider talks about. There's your outer soil. And then there's the community soil. So
this chart illustrates some of our the initial assumption that we had around economics, some of the experience we've had, and some ideas we have going forward. And we were undoubtedly naive or middle-aged and hopeful, but we thought if we did the right things for stewardship, for the land, the ecology, and the people, that would translate automatically into economic success and security, that a system based on nature or trying to emulate that as best we could learn, revenue would follow, and that the organic market would certainly support organic farmers as they grow and thrive.
Yeah, we were silly enough to think that starting a farm at age 40, which is not what we wanted to do. Doug and I met at Purdue. He grew up on a farm in Ohio that didn't survive the crisis of the 80s and had just left his full ride engineering scholarship to go back to ag, and I was still in engineering. So, you know, our joke was, is every farmer needs to find an engineer to help fund a farm. Yeah, we had no debt other than our house. We had 5 degrees between ourselves. We went to fund our farm, and I'll never forget the first meeting we had with a pretty major ag lender. And 45 minutes into the meeting, this older guy looks at me and says, "Oh, so do you work?" What? Like, you just have looked at all of our numbers, all of our budgets. Like, we knew there was a lot of things we didn't know. We knew we were entering into a new place, an ecosystem, but we had both worked in Montana. We understood the markets. We understood the network. Doug had run the organic certification program. So we at least thought, you know, we know something. We don't know anything, but we know that we can do this, and we have a lot of capacity. Well, what we've learned over 14 seasons.
Yeah, some of our experience has been much to our chagrin that as much diversity as we've thrown at a cropping system and the surrounding farm ecosystem, that is unable to overcome the influences of the larger economy. More specifically, I don't want to just repeat the bullets, but the work that we do as stewardship is either not compensated at all or is poorly so. And that happens regardless of production. The subsidies that are available, whether that's crop insurance is by far the largest one, but other direct subsidies available are very skewed towards the production of commodity crops, and I'm probably not telling anyone anything revolutionary there, but I think we were naive in thinking that we could ignore that reality and succeed regardless. We have spent, I would argue, too much of our time and effort trying to manage expenses, and you know, we've kind of honed that down to where we can look back at 5 years or 14, and our average expense is somewhere around $100 an acre to manage land, and that's in today's dollars. So it's hard to imagine being able to do anything for less than that. So we have a revenue problem, not an expense problem.
So just real quick, the pics in the middle, which is hard to see, but there are cows out there, and it's actually a failed crop. So this year we had 9% of our average production. We had 4 to 5 inches. Yeah, it was an ultimate disaster. This is coming off of 2021, where we had 34% of our average production. So let's, do we have the slide with the production on here or no?
I don't think so.
At any rate, 2021, we started the year the best ever, because for us it's all about moisture and timing and when it happens. And we got everything into the ground in a timely manner. We hosted a farm tour in June. It was the halcyon days of green, beautiful crops. Doug was doing crop surveys and saying, oh, this is an 8 out of 10. Like, how could that be? That's never happened. That's so awesome. By July, mid-July, it was 100 degrees and 50 plus mile an hour winds. And if you're a lentil, I feel like I need to do an interpretive dance. What do? You just like, you just desiccate back into the ground. So 2020, we're coming off of a tough year. So you can put that in your context of us talking about economics. So where we're going, and we'll talk a little bit more about where we're going, what we're thinking about. We have some more slides. We have a fun program we've launched called a Community Supported Stewardship Agriculture Program. I have some cards up here, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next set of slides.
Yeah, so the first image there at the bottom, that was the first year we started to farm, and we're breaking sod. We bought land that had been enrolled in CRP for 30 years and broke it out of a wheatgrass monoculture and started farming organically. So as the picture illustrates, we're very excited about that. And then the middle picture, that, as Anna said, is from last year, and we have begin to integrate grazing into our cropping system, and it was a good thing last year because that's the only way we got any kind of a interaction with the soil as the crops were failing. And then looking forward, you know, we're trying to think of some more ideas to add diversity and resilience, hopefully. But one compromise we're making is we're going to have to grow more wheat. You know, we've resisted that over the years, trying to just remain really committed to diversity. And wheat is the corn and soybeans of Montana. You know, that's the primary crop. Even in organic, there is 4 times more wheat grown than every other crop combined. So that gives you a notion of the lack of diversity. We've tried to keep it at no more than 1/7 of our rotation, but this year we're going to have to go up to more like 1/3.
So, you want to move to the next slide, Doug? I think we've got some other good stuff to show. There'll be more about the crop rotation in the keynote talk.
Let's see, I remember which way. There you go.
So, just talking about the last 5 years. So, 2022 doesn't look so bad, right? Blue is in expenses. Red is income. But what you got to remember, and you probably all know this, is when we grow things, it's almost a year lag before we actually get the income. So 2023, story unwritten here, right? Like, we don't have anything in the bin to sell. We don't have any, even though we had contracts, I don't have anything to provide those buyers. So as Doug was talking, you know, you can see our expense per acre, that's over all our acres, is it's pretty stable, right? We're not taking an income. I'm still working off the farm 3 days a week. Luckily, I can do that remotely. That was one positive thing about the pandemic, is we really learned how to use our technology. And then, as Doug also said, you know, on the right-hand side is a little bit about our five-year average around where our income's coming from. I don't like that our income comes from crop insurance, conservation payments. We've pretty much maxed out on those within our CS. There's a limit on the CSP amount, and there's only so much staff that NRCS has to continue on the EQIP stuff. So just a little bit of trying to share and be transparent about where we're coming from.
Yeah, and in particular, I'm very uncomfortable that 31% of our average income has come from crop insurance. I've made a bit of a habit of being a frequent critic of that program, so it's a bit of an embarrassment, I'll be honest, to be reliant on it as we have become.
Yeah. So as we go, one of my questions is, what is it going to take for many more of us to be a bit more transparent about farm lived reality finances? Because I think we talk a lot about our soils, we talk a lot about our ecology, but we're not talking about the economics and what do we need to do to actually have healthy economics. So you probably all got some letters like this too, this year, the last couple years, right? Like, hello, Mr. Crabtree, we're gonna increase your interest rates. This was on a loan that we took out to buy seed. You know, and we're so thankful for the opportunity to service your loan. Of course you're thankful, because all the people in the economic system get paid no matter whether it rains or not, right? So, you know, reach out to our loan accounting team as if we have a big loan accounting team to, like, respond to this. So I was thinking about this, because this isn't the only letter we got. I mean, we got lots of letters. Economic adjustment charge, fuel surcharge. I'm like, how do I charge that, right? Like, as a farmer, you're working with natural systems. I can't turn around and go to the next slide, Doug.
Well, we ask our accounting team here to respond, and they instead continued to drink. So that's what I decided to do also.
So I said, well, what do I do? Like, oh, hello, Mother Nature. I'm so thankful for the opportunity to work with you. But, you know, our interest rates are up. Some of our cost per acres have doubled. So, you know, we're not going to plant any more habitat. I'm super sorry about that. And I'm actually thinking about taking habitat out, because I need those crops to actually produce income. You know, we also aren't growing flowering crops so much anymore, because we've got to go to wheat so we can make sure we stay in business. And, you know, if you have questions or concerns, reach out to my farm accounting team, right? Like, who do we as farmers get to turn to and say this? And I think this is a piece that all of us need to be talking about more. Because, yes, we get that we are on the edge of a challenging ecosystem, and we are on the front edge of actually experiencing what climate crisis, climate variability impacts are, and that is something that's going to impact our entire planet. And there's not enough of us doing this work of growing food and taking care of land. It's less than 1% of the whole population in the U.S., as I understand, is trying to make a living from production agriculture. That's us. That's all my Kim Fallow no-till neighbors. So those of us that are doing it without all of the herbicides and pesticides is like 1% of the 1%.
Well, this is a beautiful diagram that Anna understands a lot better than I do. So let her catch her breath and then try to explain it to all of us.
Well, as I've been thinking about all the economics, there is this whole body of work called ecological economics. We got to be making friends with these people. So Hazel Henderson, I think she passed away last year, was an ecological economist. She did a lot of work on the side of the layer cake economics. So think about what you do every day, and you're an economic being. You're like working up in that top half of the cake, right? You're paying for things, you're consuming things. Gross national product, GDP, gross domestic product goes up every time somebody goes to the hospital because we spend money, right? So what do? We act as if our economic system is completely removed from our ecological system. But if you look at the lower levels of the cake, what's the base layer of the cake? I think it's totally fun that this is a food analogy. There's another female economist that writes about donut economics, so check her out too. But the base of everything that we do and need to survive and live and thrive comes from Mother Nature. Mother Nature does all these amazing things for us. Cleans our air, takes care of our water, photosynthesizes, like all the things we need to live and survive, and we go around acting in our economy as if that doesn't really exist. She also takes in all of our waste. She's amazing. So if we don't figure out how to take care of these bottom two layers, we really don't have anything. So I think this is interesting juxtaposition with the keynote speaker yesterday at lunch around what is happening with consolidation. We're all messing around in the top layers, and we're forgetting what supports everything underneath us.
Well, another simple take, as I try to understand this, is all wealth comes from nature. And the only translation of that preserves it is agriculture. Everything else is extractive and created. So we as folks acting in agriculture need to be sure that we're doing it in a restorative way. but we really have the only opportunity, and that needs to be more recognized.
Yeah, so just carrying on with this idea of economics, as I've been doing a lot of reading, I'm sure many of you have read Braiding Sweetgrass, right? Like, how does nature actually work? She works on cooperation. She works on reciprocity. There's a give, there's a take, there's a we rather than an I. And that's what we're attempting to learn to do on our farm. We're not doing it perfectly by a long shot. There's a lot of learning we can do, and I think that's what many of the rest of you are working to do. So we rather than I just love this picture. We got Highlander cattle a couple years ago, and they're keeping the little guy out, but look at their horns, right? Like, they're not stabbing each other to get to the water. It's just kind of amazing. So another area that I've been really digging into is this concept of associative economics that arises out of the biodynamic farming and agriculture world. So I was lucky enough to take a class out of Switzerland, the Demeter certification, which is biodynamic in Europe, out of the Federation, gave a class. I think I got up at 5 in the morning to do it on Swiss time, but on associative economics. And so the circle on the left-hand side is the farmer, right? And everything from the cosmos, the farmer is the one working with the cosmos. And then what happens around the table? You have a processor, a wholesaler, a retailer. We currently work in this idea of supply chains. Chains are one-way things, right? They extract what comes back. Nature works in circles and cycles. And they're proposing, and they've got some case studies in Europe where they actually take farmers and they sit down with everyone else in that supply chain and they talk transparently about their economics. What's happening? What do we need to work on together? How do we all thrive? Because if any one of us doesn't make it, the whole system falls. And those that are farming are the ones that add the most value because we're the ones working on the edge with nature.
Yeah. I had an experience a few years ago. I serve on the board of directors of the Organic Trade Association, and it's a really powerful organization, and I'm proud to be part of that. But back before the pandemic, we tried to convene what we referred to as a value chain roundtable, which was still a chain but round, and get members of the association from all layers, from producer, even input suppliers, processors, food companies, and retailers all together to talk about just this idea, and none of us had taken the biodynamic course, but it's sort of the same notion. And we had some really good initial discussions, sat around at a literal round table, and you know, we told of our challenges with risk and management, and we heard from the processors about their margins and the retailers about consumer education, all these things that we all wanted to work on together. And the point was to try to come up with some different arrangements to move products through the system, to go from crop to food. And you know, the people first assembled at this meeting were all, I think, legitimately interested in it. And so we scheduled a follow-up, and at the follow-up meeting, some of the folks that showed up were lawyers working for the major food companies. And the first thing that I heard when we started to discuss, what are some innovative contractual mechanisms we could use? And they said, well, we can't discuss that at all because that would be pre-competitive collusion, and that's illegal. And we haven't reconvened since. So we need a better way, is my point. And I
think we as farmers are going to have to keep asking for it, right? So some of the things that we are trying to do with our buyers, and they're not always the easiest conversations, but we've decided we don't have anything to lose but to ask for what we want, right? Ask for what makes our business work. That's what everybody else does, and they can just do the markup, right? Like, they're buying stuff from us. They don't actually, where is the value created in the rest of the supply chain? yeah, they're adding some packaging, they're cleaning, and I don't mean this to be dismissive to any of my processor friends, but you're not actually doing the labor work. The most labor work happens at the farm level. So we're trying to think about things like contracts per acre, revenue floor and ceiling. Sure, we'll sign up for 500 acres of grain with you for 5 years, but we're gonna have a base income of $100 an acre no matter what the production is. Kind of scary for a buyer, right? Because if we fail, where else do they get their supply? So it sets up this really interesting dialogue. We have one buyer that's furnishing our seed. That's huge. Seed's one of our top five expenses. If they can pay for the seed up front, we take a little lower price on the product in the end. That's great for us. I don't have to go borrow money. I'd just as soon share that risk and reward. So, Doug, I don't know if you want to hit a couple more of these.
Sure. Well, we can just go down the bullets, but one of the issues we've had over the years is, you know, you can negotiate a great contract that seems really beneficial, except then it might say somewhere in the fine print, delivery on buyer's call. How many have read that clause before? And sometimes that call is a year or 18 months later, and that doesn't help the cash flow at all. And in the meantime, you're responsible for the quality, which they determine. So we've tried to add clauses with reasonable timing. We try to get everything delivered within the calendar year it's grown, or certainly before the next harvest. And also we include storage fees. So if we're gonna keep it beyond the end of a calendar year, we start to add fees, as you know the other members would do if the tables were turned. We've also had clauses where, you know, if you can't take the product, let's at least pay for it. And then you can pay us to store your crop, not ours. We've had some trouble with quality specifications, which again, it always feels like a one-way street, because we like to be sympathetic, but you know, we're not in control. You know, nature largely determines what we can grow, and we've always felt like that buyers and processors should have the ability, since they're buying from a large number of growers and a large area in most cases, they can blend and they can adjust and make the recipe work. And this is not across the board, but certainly the larger entities have the ability. But what they often do is they don't pay anything for premium, but they deduct or reject at lower quality. So we've tried to be open and honest about that. And then just trying to bring it closer to home, you know, feeding our own community and finding more direct relationships, I think.
Well, we've had a couple buyers that we've tried to work with to say, okay, if you can process or make this flour, can you ship us a pallet back that we can get to our food bank? And they were totally positive of that, but the logistics of making that all happen was just too much for us to take on given the last couple of years we've had. But that is something we would like to start doing, is we feel like we're growing food, we would like to feed our community. I mean, we're a farm, like Doug said, less than 5 people per square mile, so we're not like probably many of you where you have a local community that you can feed. Our goal is land stewardship and growing food off of that. There is a million acres in Montana, and so we are a net food exporter. But we could also export clean water down the Missouri River as well.
So a couple things we'd really like to engage this audience in and brainstorm about, some kind of dream ideas we have, is, you know, in the world of biodynamics and in wine in general, there's this concept called terroir, where every season and every soil imparts a character to the grapes and to the wine that then is marketed, so that, you know, if you have a drought, that makes the end product taste this way, which is then worth more. Or if you have limestone in your soil or a particular mineral, that imparts this quality, and that is a marketing advantage at some point, and we can talk and market about that. So if grapes, why not wheat? You know, why shouldn't we be selling all of our products, vegetables, corn, whatever we grow, based on the season that we're given explain that to the consumers and the public and find value in it, whatever nature brings us.
So something for more conversation is other things that you are all dreaming of. Like if you could write your perfect contract or your perfect agreement with your buyer, what would you put in there?
Another thing that we really dream about is this, why are there elements of our cost structure that get paid regardless of what is produced when nature is the source of everything? Why can't we envision a system where we all share in whatever there is? So why should John Deere get paid for the part when we didn't make any money growing the crop? And how do we design a system where the bank, rather than getting 6% interest, or the lender, whoever that is, why don't they get some portion of the net revenue from that year? And sometimes that might be 20%, but sometimes it might be none. And that should be okay. So we're just very interested in, and we certainly don't have all the answers, but how can we derive systems that more equitably share?
So a couple other slides about things that we are doing. So we've been super lucky to establish some working relationships direct with individuals. We had a staff person, this is our tiny house, but 4 years ago we had a staff person come to us as an apprentice, stayed on for Ben to stay. He really wanted to build a tiny house that was part of his dream. That was a great thing for us because it provided housing for him. So we connected him with one of our investors, and they did a loan. So Ben put the sweat equity into his tiny house. He built his tiny house. He lived in it. He has that tiny house now, and now he's working at, I think, Broad Arrow Farm in Maine is the name of the farm. So he left us this December, which was super sad for us, but he took his tiny house with him, which is also beneficial to that farmer because that farmer also didn't have housing. So there was a way to help build equity. We also have another investor that helped us with composting equipment. So that they bought composting equipment, a side dump trailer, and the tractor. And the arrangement there is if we have a tough year, we can pay interest only. If we have a really good year where we're receiving ecosystem service payments directly for composting, we'll pay more. We'll share in that. So those are some creative thinking we're doing. We're also working with an investor on solar panels. Like, can they put up solar panels, own the solar panels? We lease the solar panels, reduces our electric costs. Same thing with fuel tanks. So we said we were buying fuel in not in bulk. And we said if we could buy fuel in bulk, it would save us 50 cents a gallon. And fuel, like seed, is one of our top five expenses. And so we were able to install these 12,000 gallons of fuel storage. And what we do each year is we calculate what we paid in fuel at the bulk price, because now we can bring a semi-truck of 10,000 gallons up, versus what did we pay in the non-bulk price, what would we have paid, and that difference makes our loan payment. So that has been super helpful to us too, because we'll achieve the savings. Ideally, we'll eventually get to electric trucks, but it's hard to envision buying an $80,000 Ford Lightning and turning it over to the farm crew. We'll get the solar panels first.
Well, and I'd love to hear, I'm sure everyone here has some innovative ideas or things that you've tried that could make everything more equitable, more of a sharing economy. So feel free, jump in anytime. The question was, do we have hunting land? And the answer is, we have land filled with wildlife, yes. And we have explored some opportunities to capitalize on that. We have not yet entered into the agreements. We have a lot of local folks, landowners themselves, friends and family of both we and they, that we like to give that access to. But I do think that is a great opportunity that we may pursue and that many can, especially when you're a little closer to population. Question?
You said that you started raising cattle.
Oh, go ahead.
I wanted to get through the PowerPoint first.
Sorry. You said that you started grazing cattle.
Technology is not our friend. I'll try to repeat the question thing.
Don't push the button, I guess. Okay, anyway. I lost my train of thought for a second. Okay, so you graze cattle. Do you graze other people's cattle? If so, is it on your plants after they've been harvested? So, like, if you're...
Yeah, well, so what we're doing is Paul, our assistant farm manager now, who's been with us for 5 years, he's launched a grazing enterprise that's integrated to our work. So we're actually bringing cows. The Highlanders are ours, but we're bringing cows from other places that need feed, and they're actually grazing our cover crops down, and then they leave at the end of the year. So that is another line of income. So that's another thing we're doing, is thinking about other sources, custom grazing, other sources of income. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and... And to answer the second part of your question, we graze what we call green manures or cover crops, which in our ecosystem, we have full season green manures built into the rotation. So now instead of mechanically terminating those, we graze them. And we also have put 1 year in the rotation that is specifically a crop seeded for the purpose of grazing. And we have crop aftermath, and in poor years, like last year, we have crops that fail but can still derive some value from the forage. So we've found all kinds of opportunities to add value and enhance soil building by bringing livestock, particularly ruminants, onto the land.
I think what I'm going to propose, unless there's another burning question, is we're going to just finish our last few slides and then open it up for
Yeah, I just want
to
recognize people if they have things up. So thank you so much. I really appreciate the conversation.
We have this always ongoing tension about momentum.
Take it away.
So another thing we've been doing is value-added marketing. So we normally ship things off in semi-loads, right, to buyers, but we've been trying to say rye is something that does really well for us. It's fairly a unique crop, so can we sell direct? So these are the guys from Glacier Distilling who are really lovely. They'll be rye in from our stuff in another 2 years. So they've invested with us in terms of buying rye each year, and it's been working out really nice. So we'd love to find a few more rye buyers. I think I've got 200,000 pounds to sell, maybe, if the rye crop does good when we harvest in July.
Yeah, and rye made into this product is one way that you can still smile after a 9% harvest.
Yeah, so our point about all this, and you all get this, stewardship happens no matter if it rains, no matter if it floods, no matter if you have crews that have mental health challenges, like it's things that are out of our control, but you're still doing the stewardship. So on that note, this is our CSSA program. So we took the CSA model and said, let's riff on that. We're not gonna sell bags of rye, but we're going to sell shares of stewardship service. So why is it you can go and buy an airline ticket and be like, do you want to offset the carbon emissions of your airline? Like, yeah, sure. Like, where does that money go? What does it actually do? So our idea is, how do we engage a community to support our farm or other farms in doing this work no matter what happens? So this has been not wildly successful, but we've got about $12,000 off this program this year so far. It's mostly been friends and family. We're talking about how to expand that to companies. Are there other mission-aligned companies that would do this? That I kind of think about, you don't have to pass them out, but we have some cards about this program. because I'd love some feedback and ideas. We got to decouple the service from our annual income stream based on crops alone. So how do we do that? And the ecosystem service market, like it's Virga. You know what Virga is? It happens a lot in the West. It's a cloud. It's a cloud formation. It looks like it's going to rain, and then you see the rain coming down, and it never hits the ground. That's what I feel is happening with all the ecosystem service money, is we're creating this whole other industry that's going to track and measure and verify carbon, and they're all going to get paid no matter how much it rains, right? How about you just pay the people that are doing the work? Did you have a question?
Comment. I work on a much smaller scale, but one of the ways we do fund our community gardens and food pantry garden is through something similar to this. And I was wondering, for us, what I call a community supported restoration has been a successful program. And basically, we charge people $10 a week, and they get a little nature bouquet, is what we call it. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, is there any way, you know, for a lot of people, this doesn't feel tangible? It doesn't feel like
right.
They're getting something back in return, even though we know they're doing a very valuable service. Are you thinking about like adding, you know, seed packets or any sort of like thank you?
Definitely in the future. So what we've done with this program is there's a newsletter that you get for each part of the season that talks a little bit in depth about what's actually happening at the farm. Because we're, you know, I think we're fairly unique in that a lot of people don't know what happens at agriculture at this scale in Montana, or how is it working? What are the crops? How do they interact? Like, so we're doing an in-depth newsletter, so there's some education. And then in connection with our nonprofit that we just launched, we want to do an artist in residence program on the farm. And so last year we actually gave an exclusive download to the artists that we hosted last year, Landon George, who did some organ work inside our grain bins. So you're gonna get some unique things like that. So this is just, we just launched this last June, so we're learning, but I think maybe there's a model here that others could use. So thank you for doing what you're doing.
Any other comments or thoughts?
I was just wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about the ecosystem service
right.
And because of all the government programs out there, and what the price of wheat is, or I'm from dairy country, Northeast Wisconsin, mm-hmm. right? And federal government has like 1.4 billion pounds of cheese in storage in a cave in Missouri because there's no market for it. But we've got dairy farms expanding because to make more money per cow. And so how you get from a point to where people see, you know, what's the real cost of food production and what, you know, what should you really pay for good organic food? Because it costs more to produce it.
It costs more. Right. You want to take that or?
Yeah, I've got a friend and mentor from Montana, Bob Quinn, who always talks about, and I think he's right on, that we have a cheap food policy in the United States, have for many decades, that is based on the idea of getting commodity crops made into indistinguishable, relatively unhealthy food, put on the shelves at a low price point. But then he would argue, and I do also, one result of that is then we have nearly out of control healthcare costs. And few of us make that connection, yet it's so obvious if you look into it. So we have this whole complex regime to get cheap food on the shelf, but to subsidize farming through invisible costs like the, what was it, $62 billion of crop insurance subsidy that was given out last year, and 40-something billion dollars in direct subsidies for growing commodities that no one wants. So you add all that up, if you added it up, the food's not actually that cheap, and then because the food is cheap, we have to spend more than any other civilized nation on health care, and we still don't cover all of our people, and we still have people hungry because of the income disparity.
I just would add, I think it's, I think it's, because I can do this easy too. It's easy to talk like big, oh, the policies, blah, blah, blah. So what I would suggest we advocate for is I want to see everybody else's expense, every farm's expense and income. And I want to see how they're splitting it out, because other farms like ours, let's daylight that. Let's talk about how much those other support systems are actually keeping us in business. Because if we can daylight that, then we can have a different conversation about where are we putting our resources. Yeah. So that's another side note.
And one of the things that Anna was so brilliant, she set the cost of this, is our basic cost, as we showed earlier, is $100 an acre. That's what it costs us to farm and to do the conservation work we do, to provide the pollinator habitat, to do all of those things. You add all that up, our annual cost is, in very rough terms, $100 an acre. So we said, if we can provide that cost, now that's not any income to us. We've never taken a salary or a draw off of the farm, unfortunately. But we said, if we can at least cover the cost, then we can keep doing this. And eventually, if we can cover the costs without having to borrow operating capital, then you can start to really gain some momentum. And so that's the nutshell, the idea.
Go ahead. Oh, one more question.
Go ahead and finish.
Oh, it's okay. I think this, I don't know.
We don't have much left.
I don't think we have much left.
In between time, you could see the improvement that they had. So now they were selling the next year of five bottles. So then we said, okay, what about the 10-year bottle? And can we put money down for the 10-year? And they said, sure. And then it's like, well, it'll be the same. It's like, no, you should charge more for the 10-year. It's going to be higher quality. If you want to pay more, it's 10 years from now. We'll keep investing in it. So I think in that upfront cost, I mean, you can add a charge for, say, we've got to store this or the other things. It's like a celebration bottle more than it is, you know, it's an investment, and honestly, their first batch was bad. but the 10-year will be better. The first year was bad, the 5 years better, 10-year will be better. So I think that's one model that maybe adding the value and having people invest early when you do a value added, so that at every one of those points we can invest, would be really great. So I'm a dietitian, and so this, I just want to connect the 2 points that you're saying about the economics and that. We've had farmers who've come to our dietetics meetings, and almost without a doubt, it will be, look how great we are, look how we're doing this production, look how we're doing technology, etc. Then when you talk to them on the side, that's where I hear all of these points that you're making. We're totally dependent on you for food. But we're also we're the people who talk to the consumers about food and farming and everybody else. So I think on that round table,
including
more nutrition people, and then to connect that, food is medicine is absolutely what the health professionals are talking about now. In that conversation, there is this gap between what food is medicine. And there's a lot of research out about the damages of ultra-processed food, so we may be changing that if that farmer voice is part of the conversation about the quality metrics that you're talking about, et cetera. And then as part of that, I'm part of working with Basil's Harvest and looking at soil microbiome and gut microbiome health and trying to figure out that health piece. In all of that, if the farmer doesn't get rewarded for that in some way, that's a lost opportunity. I don't know how that could happen, but I think if there's any ideas about how we can help with health professionals and nutrition people in that interim, but we don't know the value from farmers, and we don't know those quality metrics that you're talking about, and we don't know how phytochemicals change with that stress, which make it even more valuable, and how you could get paid for that. So there's a lot of those things in there, but there might be some opportunities with that if we can be at that round table with those conversations.
That's an excellent point. Excellent.
Yeah, I think we don't begin to know all of the science or the art even of food. We have an innate sense that food grown in a responsible manner with attention to soil life, of course, is healthier and more biodynamic, if I can use that with a small word. But I don't have the science to share. It would be exciting to be able to commune with folks from your profession and bring that message forward.
Yeah, and the question would be, how do we do that in a holistic way? Because much like I feel tremendous urgency around climate and what's happening to our planet. And you know, my background's engineering. I've done a lot of work in sustainability and green building and reducing environmental footprints of the federal agency I work for. And we can spend an awful lot of time talking about how to measure, how to track carbon, where is it going. I think we can do similar things on, like, what are the nutrient density of this particular crop? I don't think that that's wrong. I think right now we've got to get to the work of actually more people growing food, because we know what it takes to build healthy soil. We know it's diversity. We know it's crop rotations. So that's partly why we put together our institute, was to say we've had 14 seasons of learning, and we feel some urgency on getting that learning out to others or making it accessible to others. Because I don't want other farmers to have to start and then have the whole long learning curve that Doug and I had, because I think we just don't have time with less than 1% of us actually trying to do the food growing in this nation. So, you know, this is the Virga slide, right? Like, the rain never hits the ground. And this report from the UN just came up, which said, you know, we have to basically double our investments in nature-based solutions from, I can't even think of these numbers, $154 billion to $384 billion. Like, how do we make sure that just doesn't become Virga, but it's actually stuff that hits the ground and hits the farmers and the people doing the work? That, I think, is the questions we need to be asking, which means we're going to need to have very different conversations about what regenerative finance looks like.
Yeah, that's a beautiful picture. That, you know, I grew up in Ohio in the Midwest, so I'm used to thinking if you see a sky like that, you're going to get wet. But no rain from that sky actually reached the ground. And then we also have beautiful rainbows, which I love to put in pictures and I love to observe and experience. But usually when the rainbow happens, that means the chance of it raining is over. So it's mixed blessing.
Right, so back to my point of what do we need to do to allow others to enter agriculture? And I don't want to put Liana on the spot, but I'm going to put Liana on the spot. She's an apprentice who signed up with us. Gosh, when was that? 20? Long ago. Long ago, but she's farming now. You don't have to say anything, Liana, unless you wanted, but... Well, my question is like, what's it going to take? Like, you're now in agriculture, you're working in agriculture. I'd love to know if you have other ideas of how else we make this possible to bring new land stewards in.
I think the challenge that you guys have is being in at least for me, this was it, is I have no ties to Montana. I don't have family there. Community is, you're trying to build a community, and I think you're waiting for, like, enough momentum to get the avalanche going. And so the trick is, you're in a sparsely populated area, and how do you create that community so that people, I think what I learned is so much in terms of, like, farming and equipment and rotations and diversity and all those sorts of things. But in the end, for me, it was kind of like, you know, feeling like I was far from family, I didn't have, like, a really strong community, I didn't have a strong attachment to the area. And so I think that's, like, extra unique for you being in such a remote place like you are.
But you're farming now, and you found a position in it, and you're still farming.
So I'm working for a tribe in southwest of the Twin Cities, and a lot of the economic factors that are pinch points for you aren't because we're funded by a tribe and operated as a service to the tribe at this point. So we're basically just growing vegetables for the tribal community and for their natural food store on a much tinier scale. I mean, we're hardly doing tractor work anymore. If I get to drive a tractor, it's to mow a couple of acres or to drive a drill seeder over 3 acres and see some cover crop, which I love doing, but it's a rare occurrence anymore. And we have a walk-behind tractor, so totally different scale, but same principles.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing.
Thank you, and we take great pride in what little bit of we were able to pass on, and thanks for carrying it on.
And yeah, what an opportunity. I mean, I hope more people understand the opportunity you guys are offering to learn farming skills at that scale.
So Doug had to put the wildlife slide in the last one.
Yeah, we have a small pond on the farm, and for several years, I haven't seen them the last couple, but these pelicans came to visit. This one pair of pelicans always landed on the pond in the middle of summer, and we would make every effort to get out and visit them while they were there, but just nature's way of checking in with us, I guess.
All right, I think we just have open for questions and dialogue and ideas the rest of the time.
That's great. I love that you said nutrient density. That's totally what I was looking for. They keep measuring calories, and the actual issue is nutrient density. They'll measure a particular crop and not the volume of food coming off of the farm. And I wonder if there's a way to measure something similar, like if there's you're talking about carbon, it's going to take forever to measure. Like, oh, we actually built that farm in over 5 years. We don't have 5 years to do it now. You know, like, start moving, even if we don't have proof. But I wonder if there's some corollary with biodiversity that could be established of, like, you know, here are indicators that things are going in the right direction, that even if we're not there. And then I missed the very start of yours because it was an amazing peach discussion. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering about cover crops and are you getting into, I know you're probably still actually pretty far, but Gabe Brown's up that way in North Dakota, and he's gotten a lot of traction with this, like, amazing cover crop mix.
Yeah, I'll take the last part of that because I don't remember the first part, but we practice a fairly lengthy and diverse crop rotation, and in 7 years we have one for certain year of green manure, 1 year devoted to a grazing mix crop, and two others that, depending on conditions, soil moisture, fertility, weeds, all those can either be a harvested or a green manured crop, or a grazed is our new way of green manuring. And so we try, you know, at the outset, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I wanted to have this very set rotation. We're going to grow this crop this year, this crop this year, this year, and all this. And the longer we do this, the more I realize what we really need to do is have a broad concept and respond to nature and have more flexibility built in. So we don't even say, you know, we're growing wheat this year. We say we have a grain crop, and then that can be this plethora of things. Or we have a grazing or oat or broadleaf, and depending on what has happened before, we choose one of those things. And of course, you know, every farm is an organism, but every field and every strip within every field is a unique part of nature. So you can't say we're going to do the same thing across a, you know, we're a 20 miles by 16 mile footprint, so everything is unique, and we have to respond to that. But the short answer, which I'm not very good at, your question is absolutely. We grow a lot of crops as to feed the soil primarily, and harvest is only a portion of what we intend.
I think one thing we just have to be careful with around all of the soil health discussion is it's very focused on farmers and ranchers and changing what you're doing, fundamentally change your production system, which is not wrong. Because a lot of the audience that's learning about soil now or engaged are audiences that do need to have some shift. The challenge I would offer is, when do we talk about who else changes in the rest of the supply chain? because we can't have
lawns?
Like what?
Like mowing lawns.
Well, oh. Or like the processors, the wholesalers, the suppliers. Because what's happening in the organic food market is it's becoming more commodified. So we're asking farmers to change. Oh, and if you change and you use less inputs, you make more money, so you should be fine. When we're not asking any of the rest of the system to fundamentally change how they're doing business, which is what we're gonna have to do to have an economy of care. So, my soapbox.
That got you thinking about this in a different way. Some people, it's because of health issues in their family. It's, you know, a whole array of things. I'm just curious if you got a Genesis story.
Well, we all do. It's not short or simple, and we'll tell a little more about it in the noon session, but. I think Anna said at the outset, I grew up on a non-organic corn soy farm basically in Ohio, and saw that farm lost to the farm crisis in the 1980s. So I often say I was born with a disease and it's incurable, so I am a farmer. Always knew that's what I was meant to do and just wanted to get back to it, but that there had to be a better way to do it. I didn't figure out what that was for a long time, and you know, still a learning process. But I think we've discovered a lot of things that it's not. You know, we're honing the vision, as you will, and you know, today our system is much different, more diverse, more complex than it was when we started, and I see that. You know, there's a pressure every year to simplify. You know, when Anna had that diagram out front with the sun, and then there are external pressures on it, almost all of those are to simplify, to chase, quote, efficiency, unquote, to streamline. You know, we have farm meetings with the team, and everybody's like, you know, do we really need to grow 12 crops? Can we not do that? And I said, well, what do you want to not grow? And usually no one has an answer. You know, we really like rye, or we really like lentils, or we really... So at the end of the day, it's really hard to go backwards, and I think it is, but we are. You know, those pressures are, you know, frankly, you grow wheat, you can insure it at 80% for $10 or $15 an acre and guarantee 80% of your projected revenue. It's hard to grow something else.
So to your question about storytelling, I don't know that I have one Genesis storytelling, Tom, but I think the storytelling is a super important part of all of this work, because every one of us has a story of somehow our relationship with the land resonates, or what can we do to make that better. And you know, we have another apprentice, Shauna, who's now a chaplain in downtown Kansas City. So Shauna came to work for us, had never worked on an ag operation before, and had a fun and really hard year, season of learning, and then did a couple other ranch apprenticeships because she really wanted to work with animals. And then she went to Yale Divinity School. So I don't know, I don't know what that says about her experience. But you know, her whole thinking is that, you know, we've busted our relationship between humans and the land, and what can she do to help make that? So that's a story that I'm pretty proud of, even though she's not here working with us directly. She's doing work in other ways.
I think. One of the things that resonates for me, I think, about my history is, you know, I got a degree in farm management at a land-grant university, minored in crop science, and there was not one course in ecology in that course of study, and only one in biology. An awful lot of chemistry, and, you know, I know and I appreciate my education. I think you should learn how to learn, not learn what to do. Education shouldn't be vocational, but what I took out of that, I've had to forget almost all of the specifics, because, at least, this is a long time ago, but I don't think it's that much different. I don't think land-grant universities are teaching people really how to farm anymore. Maybe they don't even claim to, but they certainly didn't me. So that was an eye-opener for me. On one hand, trying to learn to experience the land and commune with that, and then having this education that was, spreadsheets and numbers and recipes, and then trying to bring those two together. And the longer I'm at it, the closer I get to more of a complex nature appreciation.
I have a question.
Go for it, Elizabeth. Great question. I haven't actually thought about that specifically, but what we've tried to do from the start of our apprentice program is 8 months first, try it. How do we all get along? Do you like it? Because so many of our apprentices have started from very little experience. And that's something we're trying to change, is recruit others that have had some experience before they come, so they know they at least want to be in agriculture. And then the idea is stay, and then let's develop what does the next few years look like. So Ben came, had an apprentice program with us, had worked on multiple farms in the Northeast, really wanted to do something large scale, thought about climate change. And he actually stayed with us for another 3 years after that and moved into more of our field technician mechanic opportunity, because he really wanted to learn more about the equipment. So that was a win for us, because we kept someone that knew our complex system and had them on payroll and continued with some learning and support and engagement in that way. We'd love to have folks come and help us continue to launch our rye enterprise or value-added sales, or we have so many opportunities. So great yeah. question, and it's something we're just trying to build out.
I think you make a really good point. I've always been a critic of programs that present themselves as apprenticeship but have no opportunity at the end, because to my understanding, that's what it means, is if you are an apprentice, you are obligating yourself to a continuing journey and a willingness to employ yourself in that field at the end. If you are an employer offering an apprenticeship, you are offering to provide an opportunity at the end, and I don't see that in a lot of them. So we are very keen to have that. I think it has to be flexible, because people are not machines, and we don't all, A, we're not all the same, and B, we don't all stay the same. So we're trying to make a suite of opportunities and help discover those together, depending on everyone's individual preference and interest. But there are tremendous opportunities, and I don't think it's just on our farm, but in rural America in general, where we can make livings, maybe not fortunes, but at least livings and healthy livings from the land, and give back to it at the same time. But long term is absolutely part of our vision.
Yeah, great question. Nope, you're up.
Yeah. I appreciate a lot your discussion about the transparency, particularly around finances and externalities. The fact that you're not getting paid as a huge externality, all the work you're doing, that if you hire someone, you would need to pay them for. I'm curious, within your apprenticeship program, if you have
have that same transparency with your finances? Do the people that work for you have a good understanding of that? Do they get to see the numbers? Do they get to see your books when they work for you?
Yeah, really great question. So that's something we're trying to really unpack for this coming year, although this coming year we had no apprentice candidates, so we're bringing in three H2A guys from South Africa. So, but we've always tried to be as transparent. The challenge that we've had is with the apprentices that have come to us, that 8 months of learning of just what does it mean to drive a tractor, to find your place on the field, to understand the crops, it's been hard to layer in that other budget. We do talk some about that at our team meetings, but not to the deep level of detail. And I mean, to be honest, I think part of the challenge is what we do when we do share. I mean, that's a stark reality. Like, oh, do I really want to do this as a career? Like, what the hell am I doing? I'm here in the middle of Montana with no people, with these crazy people. So I think there's a challenge.
We don't want to scare them away. Although we seem to have been very successful at doing just that.
There's this huge cultural narrative too about don't go into farming. And yeah. So I don't know if that helped answer your question. But.
So when you had your list of shared costs that you would like to achieve, things like the storage fees, it seems extremely reasonable. This is kind of a multi-part question. I want you to tell us what response you got. Tell us more about the response you got when asking for any of those. Who are you selling your grain to? Is it a farmer co-op or a business? And do you feel like you have the power individually or collectively to even achieve those modest steps? Mm. That list is a state of business.
Right.
Let me try and take that one step at a time. We are part of a small and growing organic producers cooperative where we are trying to do just that, because no one of us as farmers, despite the fact that we are few in number, there are still way more of us than there are buyers, and they exert what in economics is called market power. And in those negotiations, generally how it works is either they don't offer a contract at all, or if they do, they hand you one that's this long and full of fine print that their lawyers made up, and you can sign it or not. Those are your options. And we just have chosen not to do that. And we're very lucky to be in, in organic. The terms are relatively better. So we're able to say, we will not sign a contract without an act of God clause, for instance. Never have, never will, not going to do that. You are going to take that risk with us at a very minimum. And then we'll talk about other things that you can do with us. So by sticking to our principles and only dealing with companies that are willing to engage, now that means we don't have friends or partners, some of which show up at conferences like this and drive new trucks here and sponsor and do lots of great things, but if they're not willing to engage in a dialogue about risk sharing, we are not willing to engage with them in a dialogue about being their supplier.
So the high level talking point I'd say is diversity in all things. So we have a spectrum of buyers, everything from Glacier Distilling that takes one load of rye that we get toll processed at a processor in Montana, to the other end of the spectrum where they're gonna come and bring semi-trucks and load the peas out of our bin and deliver those to Iowa. And in each of those, if we can actually have a relationship or a conversation with a human that's doing the contract, that's what the difference is. If it's like what Doug said, here's the contract, no change, we're just gonna go find somebody else, because the organic market is growing, there's so many opportunities, you just have to be a bit more creative and tenacious about finding people that actually wanna have a relationship. So that's been our experience.
Yeah, but I don't wanna undersell. A kernel of what you said was that farmers need to be much more cooperative. We need to work together in order to take some power back in that dynamic to make it a community rather than a transaction.
Hi. When I see your last photo here with the amazing habitat and the wildlife and the birds, and I wonder, it speaks so much to the hunger that we know people have to get back to nature, to connect with nature, and we know that there's so many people that live in places where they can't do that. And when you're thinking about your stewardship share, I love that idea, and it's something that we've kind of tossed around in our own farm in Minnesota, or small farm compared to yours. And we thought about like farm stay or having mm-hmm. people visit, and I'm curious if you've
yeah.
considered that kind of thing, and even like having your stewardship shareholders have that opportunity if they, you know, purchase.
Yes, yes, we have. We've thought about tiers, like come for a farm dinner or stay in the tiny farm office, or, you know, a whole nother enterprise that we've talked about too is could we get someone that would just do the agritourism? Because I have this desire to bring people to our farm, because once you see our system compared to the next door system of chemical fallow, and it's chemical fallow, it's dead for one whole year, because we're only cropping every other year in our ecosystem given the water. You can't unsee that. So yes, go for it. And you have to find what works for your business. Like agritourism for us, like so many opportunities, like the hunting question, right? Like, oh, I just cannot take that on because I'm busy trying to just do the crop business first. But could we envision somebody else coming to the team that would be their role?
Yeah.
That's the what?
The intern you need.
Yes.
Oh.
You can put up the
CSA. So I wanted to show the tiny house.
Oh, the tiny house. Gotcha. Other questions? What is everybody else doing?
We want some more ideas.
Are we whacked for actually trying to be a little transparent here on our finances? We don't talk about money a lot in this world at all. Like, our whole culture is like, ooh, money.
So I'm curious about the H-2A visa program. You know, it's getting a lot of flack right now as a form of indentured servitude. You know, you basically have control of their visa and are able to kind of manipulate and exploit people on those H-2A visa programs. And so, you know, obviously, you guys seem like wonderful people and are not doing it quite at the scale that
right.
a lot of the Iowa model customers are doing. But I was just curious what protections have you put in place, and, you know, what best practices have you researched to kind of employ in that situation? Because I know it is something that is a really hot topic that I think is going to get reformed in the next couple of years, or I hope will be reformed in the next couple of years.
Yes. We didn't really want to have to go that way, because we had hoped that we would find folks in the U.S. that would come and stay, and the labor issue is all over, and we've talked to several other farmers in our ecosystem that are using H-2A, and they've had really good luck, because these folks want to just come and work. So we are working with a firm in Lewistown, Montana, that works with several recruiters, specifically in South Africa, that does some screening. Then Doug spent like a whole week just reviewing resumes and the applications, and we did a lot of interviews, and we talked about our farm and what we're doing. So in terms of best practices with the three of them, we actually set up a Google Hangout chat with all of them, because they're in different parts of the country, so that they can meet each other and share, because they're all going to be sharing a whole house that we have rented, that they each get their own bedroom and shared kitchen. So we're trying to do the best. It's not ideal. And what's really fascinating to me is people will come work for an hourly wage and they're super excited about it. Because I just can't imagine what some of the conditions are in these other countries to have you leave.
Yeah.
So if you have some ideas of other best practices, I'd love to hear them and see that list.
I think just making sure you know you hold the card to their
feet. Yeah.
So if there are any HR complaints or anything like that, you guys are going to help.
Undeniably. Yeah. Well, they're full part of our team. We're going to be working with them every day, and we have weekly team meetings, so they're key to our whole team. And so,
yeah. Yeah, I guess honestly, I'm a little ignorant of the abuse or issues that you discuss. I want to own that up front, but we're pretty frustrated and sad, and one of the things we're going to talk about in the larger talk today is we had this dream and vision of, you know, if you build it, they will come, that there are all these people that want an opportunity to farm. We just haven't found them, and we've looked pretty hard, and we come to meetings like this and to universities and other places, and there are a lot of people clamoring for access to land or clamoring for opportunity, and I just want to kind of shake them up and say, well, go to where the land is. You know, you can't all farm outside of San Francisco or Minneapolis. You know, I don't know why you'd want to, but anyhow, that's me. But I think there has to be a reality that, yes, we want community and we want to build community, but in order to do that, somebody has to be the pioneers. And sure, that's going to be hard, but you got to join us in the effort. And don't be solely frustrated by the fact that you can't afford the $30,000 an acre land that is next to Starbucks. You know, come out to where the land is and let's make a community that is healthy. But I don't know, that seems to land on deaf ears.
It takes a special person, and Doug's an introvert. Yeah, we haven't directly, but that's part of the vision of the nonprofit. And I also really am visioning a connection with some of our tribal members in Montana. Like, we are lucky to steward the land. We've had this gift of land that we have. Like, we're not going to be the last stewards of it, and nor were we the first. And I think that there's a lot that we can learn from those communities as well. So yes to all of that, and I'm hoping eventually part of the vision is, could there be someone on the nonprofit staff that actually does some of that and talks about the opportunities that exist in the Northern Great Plains?
Well, and one of the ways we have reached out, we're members, founding member of the Montana Organic Association. That's our state-based sort of marble seed-like group. And through MOA, we have engaged with FFA. I have to say it has been a bit frustrating because those blue jackets are largely bought by Bear, and they're pretty entitled or beholden to the interests of non-organic agriculture. That's hard to overcome. I don't think it's with the young people themselves, but at some point the indoctrination happens. But the leaders go where the money is. And, you know, we also have to be honest. We're 1%. You know, we're 1% of the land, 1% of the farmer. The other 99%, I think rightfully, has more control of the 4-H and the FFAs. And we need to reach out.
It's about relationships. So if you can build a relationship with a young individual, do it, however it takes to make that happen.
Okay, we're down to 3 or 4 minutes, but
we're around. Thank you all for just listening and questions. I have some CSSA cards if anyone wants them. And Elizabeth, help us out. Any other ideas any of you have or thoughts?
Yeah,
Yeah, one in the back. And it's so beautiful to get to see the river and the... What kind of trees are those? Like, in our world, that would be cottonwoods, but I don't know.
This is a comment and a connection and probably any question that we can't answer immediately. But the gentleman up there earlier asked about the Genesis story. But those who are of a certain age didn't start organic. Most of the farmers started conventional. The guys that are my dad's age. And they had a combination of experiences that caused them to go through conversion in a shift. And when we talk about fighting for change, we want to do change. And we think about, you know, Austin's presentation yesterday, at what level of the system we fight for change. Those are all good and important. But we also have to appreciate that. Ask yourself when the last time that badgering by somebody else with their own righteous cause got you to go, oh, hey,
right.
Like, there has to be a setting of conditions for each of us, and it's multiple variables, to go into those moments of what makes us shift. And so, Anna, to your last comment to that gentleman, you said relationships. And that is it.
Mm-hmm.
It's it in nature. It's it with humans. It is the question. How do we create the conditions to build relationships with other people to give them the opportunity to change? And I think ultimately it becomes a question of radical collaboration of how do you create relationships with your opponents? And if that sounds batshit crazy, I spent almost a year in Iraq in 2007 working with an insurgent tribe who previously not saying it's easy, but I'm saying there's a time where fighting doesn't work anymore. So how do you use that energy to find somebody, to create a relationship and find the space to give them the opportunity to change?
Yeah.
I don't have the answer. I have some experience with it.
I'd say yes, it's all about relationships. I mean, we have neighbors that clearly are not appreciative of our production system. But when there's a fire in the community, we all show up.
Well, most of us.
Most of us. What do you mean?
There are neighbors that don't have anything to do with the fire district.
Yeah, but the ones of us that do all show up. And I think for us, personally, I don't know about Doug, I feel like our best work is to just continue to try to be a model of something different, an experiment. I think people are watching us, our community's watching us. They're super intrigued about, wow, you guys work really hard, but you bring all these young people to our space. How does that happen? And so when you have an opportunity to have a conversation, you just have a conversation, but you don't, we're not out like, and we're here, right? So organic is the way. That's our belief. But we're not out beating that drum loud and clear in our own local town. We're just trying to have relationships.
So yeah.
I don't know if that helps.
I would offer that I try not to be evangelical about how we farm. If people are interested, I'm more than glad to share the hows, the how, the whys, the, you know, everything. But I'm not out to convert anyone. And part of that stems when I did my education, I studied 100 some odd organic farmers and their backgrounds and how they got to there. And what I found was organic farmers are much more likely to be educated, you know, post-secondary educated, but less likely to be trained in agriculture. And organic farmers are much more likely by three or four times to not come from a family farm or a background. So these are facts. What I believe is that, yes, we should offer the opportunity to anyone and everyone. including farming neighbors and people in the community. But also, there's a rich population of people who are not from farms, but who want to farm or want to be part of the food system. And I believe those are the more likely individuals to become organic farmers. And while not being exclusive to anyone, I have chosen, at least personally, to put more energy into teaching people to farm organically from the start than convincing anyone to convert. As I just think it's a lot easier to teach someone whose mind is already open than it is to change someone's mind. But I you know, again, I'm not an evangelicist. That's just my personal opinion.
I got the zero minute mark. Doug and I are around. Thank you all for participating.
Yeah, hope to see you at lunch.
Oh, Wild Farm. I almost said something about Wild Farm. Yeah. That's great.
And I know Neva. I'm one of her first
students. Oh, that's such a small world. That's great.
And you guys are already doing, if you look at the table of contents, I think it gives you a
overview and part two
of, like, you know, replacement U.S. workers.
You
guys
are already doing that. Where are you? Where are you in Minneapolis? Okay, we would love to do some more work with the Wild Farm.
But the real thing that I always say is
here, I'll give you a card.
I've heard about that.
Please steal.
We've had to
steal
have
away.
Like Thank three
you.
Inspections.
Here you go, Shelly. The institute's on the one side. Right. And then CSSA. Yeah, take one too. Thank you, Francis.
Because my first experience with it, I was like studying in Israel, and it was like, you know, all of the Australian, you know, people on agricultural visas.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
One set of housing, and then the agricultural.
Don't know how our own little tension like going, but I have to.
And it was
I have heard of that.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. That's great. Well,
thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well, it's got color.
Outstanding. Thank you.
Nice.
Let me shut this off.
Well, I wanted to just do some more, hi, Mike. Thank you.
Good day today and a safe trip.
Thank you. All right. Oh, yes.